From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1933 when Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act. And that's a term you've probably heard often in this presidential campaign. Glass-Steagall was a law designed to set up a kind of wall between commercial and investment banks to make sure your basic savings and checking accounts were protected from risky behavior on the investment side. It's named for Senator Carter Glass and Congressman Henry Steagall. And for decades, Glass-Steagall was the law of the land. But after years of pressure to deregulate, Congress essentially repealed Glass-Steagall in 1999. And since then, there's been furious debate about what that means and what it has caused. It turns out, though, both major parties now want to bring back Glass-Steagall. At least they say they do in their platforms. So what would that mean for Wall Street and for you? What about your money, your 401ks, and more? Let me welcome my guest for the hour, and I will say, it's a little bit of a dry subject, but I don't think it should be. This is just about as important as it gets when it comes to presidential politics and policy in this country. So our guests for the hour include Amit Banabial. He's a professor of economics at RIT. And thank you for coming back, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
And also here is Joe Boyd, Vice President and Financial Advisor for Brighton Securities. Joe, welcome.
Thank you.
And Joe, you know, once in a while, do you ever have a client who says, hey, I heard Glass-Steagall again. Tell me about that. Does that come up at all?
Thus far, it has not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suspect maybe that will change. And will that be healthy if more of us are talking about this kind of thing, Professor?
Sure. More economics knowledge never hurt anybody.
Well, what I want to do to kind of set the stage for what it is, because is listen to a few different things here. First of all, I'm going to want Professor Banabial to kind of tell us whether what we're hearing is fair, a fair historical representation. And then we'll have a nice conversation with our guests and with you this hour about what it means, and especially going forward. So let's start with, of all things, Aaron Sorkin and the newsroom. Aaron Sorkin decided he wanted to weigh in on Glass-Steagall and a little American history in his fictional show, The Newsroom. Here's a scene from the show with two characters talking in a bar over drinks, which inevitably, as it does for all of us, leads to Glass-Steagall.
After the Great Depression, Congress wanted to put a firewall between the investment banks and the commercial banks. They wanted to make sure that Wall Street could melt to the ground and the commercial banks wouldn't be touched. They passed a law, the Glass-Steagall Act. Now, you could be Gordon Gekko or George Bailey, but you couldn't be both. It helped lead to the largest sustained period of economic growth in U.S. history, a 60-year expansion of the middle class, the largest increase in productivity, and the largest increase in median income. We also won World War II, put a man on the moon and a computer in everyone's lap. And you know what happened next?
We cheated on the perfect guy with the guy who dumped us.
Yes, we repeal Glass-Steagall.
Okay, so is that oversimplifying or does Sorkin have it right? Well, on July 7th of 2015, Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke on the Senate floor about the impact of Glass-Steagall.
Glass-Steagall played a central role in keeping our country safe. Traditional banking stayed separate from high-risk Wall Street banking. There wasn't a single major financial crisis, and the financial sector helped contribute to a sustained, broad-based economic growth that helped build America's middle class. But the big traditional banks wanted the higher profits they could get from taking more risks. And investors in the big investment banks wanted access to the low-cost insured deposits of traditional banks. So they teamed up to try to tear down Glass-Steagall's wall. Starting in the 1980s, regulators at the Federal Reserve and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency buckled under industry pressure and began poking bigger and bigger holes in the wall between investment and commercial banking.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren. So you've got a narrative building here. Effectively repealing Glass-Steagall in 1999, the narrative goes, allowed banks to go back to behaving in a much more risky fashion, emphasizing short-term profits and ultimately crashing the economy in 2008. But wait, Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, was called before Congress in 2010 to talk about the financial crisis. And he told reporters that day that blaming the repeal of Glass-Steagall is unfair and has no basis. The sound you're about to hear comes from Bloomberg News. It's a bit echoey. I apologize for that. But you're going to hear Dimon defending the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
One of the things that came up today is, did Glass-Steagall coming down caught the problems? Remember, most of these problems are monoline investment banks, finance companies, insurance companies, mortgage brokers, and thrifts. They were not because of the combination of combination of commercial banking and investment banking. And size, look, I think the commission will be looking at these facts. A lot of companies are big because they're required to be, because the economies of scale, the size of the investments, the size of the data centers. You know, J.P. Morgan does business in 100 different countries. We lend billions of dollars to California. We follow Fortune 500 companies around the world and help them do what they do. You can't do that if you're small.
All right, that's Jamie Dimon. So that leads us to this presidential campaign. During the primary, Senator Bernie Sanders and Governor Martin O'Malley challenged Hillary Clinton to support the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall. Here's Clinton during a debate on CNN last October, claiming that her plan on banking was the toughest, even though it did not call at the time for bringing back Glass-Steagall. And you will hear O'Malley at the end of this challenge her briefly.
Of course, we have to deal with the problem that the banks are still too big to fail. We can never let the American taxpayer and middle-class families ever have to bail out the kind of speculative behavior that we saw. But we also have to worry about some of the other players. AIG, a big insurance company, Lehman Brothers, an investment bank. There's this whole area called shadow banking. That's where the experts tell me the next potential problem could come from. So I'm with both Senator Sanders and Governor O'Malley in putting a lot of attention onto the banks.
You hear O'Malley say, actually, you're not. But we know what happened after that. Hillary Clinton won the Democratic nomination, but she was pushed to adopt some of Senator Sanders and the other candidates' positions at the party convention last month. The new Democratic Party platform includes a proposal to reinstate Glass-Steagall. That's a win for Bernie Sanders. But much to the surprise of Wall Street, as CNBC reported, the Republican Party platform rolled out and also includes a call to reinstate Glass-Steagall. So now both major parties are at least ostensibly pushing for this outcome. Let's start here. Professor, was the history largely accurate, or do you have a problem with simplifying it in the way that you heard there from the newsroom to Elizabeth Warren?
I would say it was partially accurate. I mean, Elizabeth Warren's attributing the fact, or claiming rather, that there were no problems, there were no crises at all up until 1999, when Glass-Steagall was in fact repealed, is factually false. In the 1980s, we had the big problem with the SNL, that's the savings and loan crisis, which cost American taxpayers somewhere in the vicinity of $150 billion. After that, long-term capital management, a big hedge fund failed. That too happened when Glass-Steagall was law. So these are two examples of major problems that occurred with financial events in our country in the presence of Glass-Steagall. On the other hand, what the J.P. Chase Morgan CEO, Mr. DiMond, is saying is true in parts. Now, he claims that size matters, and I hope we'll get into the size issue in greater detail. And it does matter, but up to a point. The big problem, if I had to sum it up in one sentence with the financial industry here, is that some banks, be it commercial or investment, are too big to fail. And that is the specific problem that we need to address in any subsequent reform. And it's not clear to me that Glass-Steagall per se, at the exclusion of other reforms, addresses that problem.
All right. So just a point of clarity as well for our listeners this hour. Neither one of our guests are here to endorse any sort of political party or candidate, and that's sort of obvious, but I wanted to make that point here because we are talking about Senator Warren, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders. We'll be talking about Donald Trump. You're going to be hearing some of his comments from yesterday. But this isn't an opportunity for our guests to say anything close to an endorsement. It's a question of examination of policy and proposals and ideas. That is it. Now, far be it for me to speak for Elizabeth Warren, but I have heard her in separate settings say that the decades of sort of smooth sailing, for lack of a better term, after 1933 and after Glass-Steagall was passed, started to end in the 80s because, as she puts it, the pressure to deregulate was on there. So yes, the repeal didn't happen until 99, but it was that pressure, that little drib and drab of deregulate, that helped lead to the SNL, et cetera. Is that...
That part is factually true. Okay. I mean, it is true, for instance, that the spirit of Glass-Steagall was attempted to be, broken, by stealth, if you will, where the Federal Reserve Board, for instance, allowed investment banks or traditional banks to, for instance, play the casino, basically, but with limits, 5% of their total revenue, things of that sort. So there was a stealth movement. And of course, American banks complained that their rivals on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean were not subject to any similar regulations. So they were at a competitive disadvantage. And hence, wouldn't it be nice if they could, in fact, play the game the way banks on the other side of the Atlantic were playing. And there was some level of investor pressure as well to tap into those high profits. So high risk and high profits go together, and the banks wanted to take advantage of that to the extent possible.
Okay, Joe Boyd is someone who helps people manage their money and understand their money. When it comes to Glass-Steagall, when it comes to the size of banks and the current state, the current landscape, are there things that trouble you? Is there anything that does concern you, whether Glass-Steagall or not, when it comes to where money is going and possible risk? I mean, the big question after 08 was, are we still too big to fail? Has Dodd-Frank done enough? And I'm curious to know right now if you have any consternation about money and the where it's going and how well protected it is.
I guess my position on the too big to fail argument or question is that there are the two sides of the traditional savings and loan side of a bank, along with the side that does the investments. And one of the things that I was having a conversation with some coworkers yesterday about was the financial crisis and some of the things that contributed to that. And one of the things that was brought up was the mispricing of risk that's associated with the mortgage-backed securities that were bundled together and sold, and how that was funded through low-cost capital on the savings and loan side. And so it is somewhat of a situation where you have the low cost of capital from the savings and deposits of regular people that could be, well, it's really hard to track exactly which dollar that I put into my savings account or checking account is where that's going. But that could be construed as being used for other more riskier activities. And that, I guess, to me personally is a little bit concerning. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, we need to also trust that the regulators are doing their jobs, that the lawmakers are doing their jobs, and everybody is, you know, looking out for the best interests of their clients.
I am the least expert person on these financial matters of anyone I interview all year long. But I always feel like when you say the regulators do their job, I go back to Andrew Ross Sorkin's book and I think, man, the regulators were often the guys who couldn't get the high-paying jobs. You know, they got the five-figure jobs on Wall Street. Let's pay them more. My tax dollars, you want to pay the regulators more? That is fine with me. But I share your optimism that at the very least, if they're doing their jobs. You also, before the hour began, were making the point that 1933 and 2016 are not perfectly apples to apples, or at least the intentions of the law. What do you think there, Joe?
Right. So Glass-Steagall, you know, to separate the traditional banking with the investment banking side, because before Glass-Steagall and part of what led to the Great Depression was that there was no FDIC. And when people put their money into a savings account, the bank could use that money to invest in the stock market. And when the stock market went down and there was a crash that led to the Great Depression, then people's savings were no longer there for them. Well, the kind of investment banking that was going on pre-Great Depression crisis is very different than the kind of investment banking that goes on today. I mean, today there's significantly greater complexity in regard to the investments in the proprietary trading and the arbitrage trading and currency that was not around back in, you know, 1933 and before.
But is the principle the same?
I think that the principle, yes, is the same. That I think the Glass-Steagall would essentially want to try and prevent anybody's safe money to be used for unsafe activities or investment activities.
Okay, so you heard the professor mention that Glass-Steagall essentially is not a panacea. That there may be value there, but it would be it would be a negative part of this campaign and this discussion and discussions like it to allow people to think, hey, just pass Glass-Steagall again and we're good to go on Wall Street. But here's a question from a listener named Dan who says, Evan, the professor says that reinstating Glass-Steagall will not make sure another crisis is avoided. No doubt he's right. But does he believe Glass-Steagall is at least a useful hedge against financial crises and therefore should be reinstated?
Okay, so that's a good question. So the answer to that is maybe. So let me try to explain what maybe might mean in relatively simplistic terms. So if you look at the evidence post-2008, we had three kinds of institutions that were problematic. One, the so-called investment banks, example Bear Stearns. Second, the so-called universal banks to whom Glass-Steagall would actually apply. That is, these are entities that provide both investment services as well as traditional banking services. And probably the best example is Citigroup, maybe even Bank of America. And then you have the third category. These are your so-called traditional banks. An example would be Wachovia. Okay. All three of these three different categories of institutions failed or were in serious trouble in the aftermath of 2008. Yet, Glass-Steagall would only affect the second category, Citigroup, Bank of America. So what we need is a multi-pronged approach which realizes, as Joe pointed out, that in this day and age, banking, particularly shadow banking, is so complex in ways that Senator Glass could never have foreseen in 1933, that we need to have a comprehensive approach to this particular problem. And the central point that I would like to point out in this regard is, when banks want to grow big, and that's what Mr. DeMond was claiming, mm-hmm. that size matters, up to a point that argument makes sense. But the perverse incentive here is that banks want to grow big, not just because of economies of scale arguments, but they want to grow big because there's an implicit federal guarantee that the larger the institution is, the more likely they will be bailed out if something goes wrong. And that's the advantage that they take. They maximize, if you will, milk it for everything it's worth. That if we're a big institution, all else being equal, the chances that Uncle Sam's going to bail us out is much greater. And at the same time, the probability of something going wrong increases as you get big in size.
And moral hazard comes into play
there.
That's right.
And that's what we need to address. And Glass-Steagall doesn't address that.
Okay. And so it sounds like you agree with some of the criticism I read. Here's Stephen Perlstein writing in the Washington Post, in defense of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, he writes the following, quote, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch, three institutions at the heart of the crisis, were pure investment banks that had never crossed the old line into commercial banking. He says the same goes for Goldman Sachs, another favorite villain of the left, it's the famous AIG insurance firm, New Century Financial, a real estate investment trust, no Glass-Steagall there. Perlstein writes, quote, two of the biggest banks that went under, Wachovia and Washington Mutual, got into trouble the old-fashioned way, largely by making risky loans to homeowners. Bank of America nearly met the same fate, not because it had bought an investment bank, but because it had bought Countrywide Financial, a vanilla variety mortgage lender.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So at least we're alighting on some agreement that we don't want to overplay, though there are people like Joseph Stiglitz, people much, again, really highly regarded, who believed that at least with Glass-Steagall, the incentive became for the investment side to trump the commercial side for the risk and the size. And that's a symptom of the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So let me grab a phone call, and I'll tell our listeners. There's a lot more we want to talk about this hour with our guests. And if you've got questions, Glass-Steagall and related issues, 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Mike in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, hello. I heard it mentioned that the... kind of the suggestion was made that, presumably we can trust the regulators to regulate. But that is clearly not true. I mean, it was certainly most of the revenue streams have to do with curing favor with the banks and the institutions that they're supposedly regulated. Or at least that was true of the... I can't remember now. I'm sorry. I'm not thinking of what it was. Whether it was the SEC or what, but they clearly did not do their jobs. And I'm thinking of the Standard and Poor's, the rating agencies, and the regulators. Just they were either overwhelmed or looking the other way or something. And I don't see any reason to presume that anything is substantively changed here. It was like the banks were driving the boat down the road, and that was that. And devil take the hindmost. I don't know if Glass-Steagall, again, good idea. Will it solve everything? Obviously not, but it's certainly worth as a piece. But trying to get comprehensive legislation, so far Congress is pretty much hostage to banks, and I think the administration is too. And one final point is I think it's interesting that Hillary wants to reinstate Glass-Steagall since it was repealed under her husband's tenure in office as president.
Mike, thank you for the phone call. I'll ask both of our guests, starting with our economics professor. Are you concerned that the regulators are not doing their job for whatever the reason, either they're incompetent, overwhelmed, or otherwise?
Up to a point. So the caller Mike referred to, he lumped both the ratings agencies and regulators together. So I think there's little sympathy for the ratings agencies. They really screwed up and didn't do their job. There's no question about that. But I have a lot more sympathy for the folks at the SEC. That's the Securities and Exchange Commission. These people are horrendously overworked. Mm-hmm. They get paid a pittance of what some of their junior colleagues on Wall Street get paid. And the government often sends contradictory signals about whether to go hard in terms of prosecuting some of these malfeasant behavior or whether to actually go easy on them. So I would be a little more, accommodating to some of the SEC employees. But we definitely need to increase their ambit, increase their salary, and hire more of them. Because as we've been talking, the nature of these financial activities is so complex, you can't expect a relatively small office to do its job thoroughly over and over again. But the ratings agency is a completely different game.
Yeah, I do think, you know, it just surprises me as a taxpayer. That's the one thing that is so obvious to me. If these are the people paid the least on Wall Street, that is not going to be a desirable job. We should make it so that, you know, you want to be a police officer. You want to be a regulator. You want to be someone who is going to be making some of those, you know, decisions and evaluations, and starting with pay.
Yeah,
a lot of money on Wall Street.
Absolutely.
But up the pay.
You'll remember, if you've seen The Wolf of Wall Street, at one point in time, some of these regulators were invited to come on Leo DiCaprio's boat and have a discussion with shrimp, you know, expensive liquor, etc. Those regulators barely see that kind of lifestyle ever. So it's very easy
for them. But that's just fiction, Professor.
Oh, no.
There's a reason that it's so popular. Joe, what do you think? Joe Boyd, go ahead.
Just to clarify, I think I had said that I hope that the regulators are doing their job, not necessarily saying that they definitely are, or that we can necessarily have the most confidence that they are. But I think the two of you both touched on a very good point that, and I don't know how to say this without coming across the wrong way, but it seems that Wall Street and industry attracts the best and the brightest. And because they get rewarded with high salaries and great benefits and huge bonuses. And the JV group is kind of the people who end up can't getting a job on Wall Street and end up working as a regulator or for the government. And so maybe that is actually a great place to start, is how do we make it so that the incentive is to be on the side of the regulator versus on the side of the bank, and how do you fund it and everything else like that. So, but that, you know, I think we've touched on something that would be a good start, or at least I think a better start than just saying, let's bring back Glass-Steagall. Because even if we bring back Glass-Steagall, I don't think that we would want exactly the same thing. It would be a version of it that applies to today's investment banking world.
Okay, and for our listeners, particularly our conservative listeners who are hearing the word regulation and regulator a lot, nobody here is saying we love all regulation or we want, you know, absolute domination by the regulators. We just want effective people. Whatever the rules that you set are, you got to have effective people in the game, and that's kind of what the panel is saying here. We're going to get our only break of the hour in. The phones are ringing. We're going to get back to your phone calls. We'll close the loop with our listener named Dan, who emailed earlier to ask Professor Bonabial if he thinks Glass-Steagall is at least a good hedge. He's following up just to ask, as a philosophical question, does our panel think that speculative banking should be separated? So we'll close the loop on that. And if you missed some of what you heard from one of the presidential candidates yesterday during this hour on this program, we have a section that some on CNBC said was contradictory. If you support Glass-Steagall, then you can't say XYZ. Well, then what did Donald Trump say yesterday? We'll also have that for you. So let's get our only break of the hour and come back with much more next. Coming up in our second hour, walkability in the suburbs. It's not an oxymoron or a contradiction in terms. Some suburbs in Western New York have become pretty walkable. Other suburbs are not really interested in walkability. We're going to talk about what we expect when we're homeowners, when we're renters, when we're in the suburbs, not just the city. Walkability beyond the urban scene, next hour. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Robert in Fairport, Fred in Penfield. Stay right where you are. We're coming to you in a minute. Professor of Economics from RIT, Amit Bhattabiyal is here. Joe Boyd's the Vice President and Financial Advisor for Brighton Securities. We're talking about Glass-Steagall, the Banking Act from 1933 that you hear so often in the news today because both presidential contenders, at least the major party candidates, are saying bring it back. Elizabeth Warren has been beating that drum for a number of years now, and you're starting to see pop culture references to it. Is it a panacea? Our panel says it's not a panacea. It might be at least a smart idea in terms of separating commercial banking from investment banking. And Dan just follows up, Professor, to say, just philosophically, should we separate? Should speculative banking be separated from commercial banking?
I think philosophically, in this day and age, it may make sense depending on what else you're doing with it. So if I look at something comprehensive like Dodd-Frank, which attempts to do many different things, after all, it's 800 pages long, the legislation, then you may not need Glass-Steagall. But the idea that, you know, you're gambling with my hard-earned money is something that strikes a deep chord in the minds of most Americans. And I think that is something that we need to take a look at, because after all, we live in a representative democracy.
Okay. So, Dan, hope we've answered that question there. I'm going to grab Robert in Fairport next up. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, it's an interesting, excuse me, it's an interesting discussion. I don't think a lot of the things that went wrong in 2008 have been fixed, though. I mean, if you look at the rating agencies, a lot of these guys have to they're rating securities, but at the same time, if they give a security a poor rating, they sort of cut off their nose in spite of their face. They're going to lose business, and their business interests are tied with the people who are issuing the bonds. So there's sort of there's a natural conflict of interest there that was never fixed. And the other topic here is that nobody's mentioning derivatives. Nobody has any idea what these things are going to be valued at if everything crashes.
Okay. Hold on. Stay there, Robert. What do you guys think here? Joe, you want to start? Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I didn't want to go too far into the weeds when I was talking about investment banking, but derivatives are one of the things that was connected with the financial crisis. You know, everyone doing these credit default swaps on the mortgages that were bundled in the bonds. So, and you bring up, I guess, exactly what I was talking about, that the investment banking of, you know, and derivatives being included in that investment banking group is something that was never around in, you know, 1933 when Glass-Steagall was enacted, and that was never even, I think, dreamed of as something that would be considered investment banking.
Professor?
I think the caller is absolutely right in the first part of what he said, that there is a definite conflict of interest between the ratings agencies and the investment banks. The ratings agencies rely on some of their investment banks for their revenues. So, you know, if they gave a low rating to a particular financial product, that might come back to haunt them. So that part is absolutely true. But the second part, you know, actually recalls a broader issue, this whole category of shadow banking. Derivatives are one kind of instrument over which the SEC has virtually no say whatsoever. But more generally, we have, you know, institutions like hedge funds, of which there are many right now, which have no regulation whatsoever. So it's the shadow banking and a sector and its size in contemporary times, which is a significant player. And we need to do something about making sure that these shadow banking players play by some kind of clearly defined rules. And once again, looking at Glass-Steagall to the exclusion of other things does little to address this problem.
Robert, you want to follow up there?
Yeah, I think the thing with the derivatives that's interesting is that if you look at how a lot of the pension funds are now investing, a lot of that money is going in hedge funds. And if the hedge funds are unregulated, what's going to happen the next time we have a crash like this? You're going to have a lot of public pension funds, you know, that are going to be having a major financial issue.
That's potentially true, and that's one of the reasons why some of the more, you know, intelligent reformists have talked about making sure that investment banking entities, and maybe we need to drag in more players from the so-called shadow banking sector, have to put up significantly higher capital requirements than what they are required to do right now to make sure that if they go bust as a result of bad bets or just plain bad luck, pension holders, other depositors are not adversely affected to the extent that they were in 2008. But that's part of the comprehensive legislation and reform of the banking sector that we need.
Can I follow up with a Glass-Steagall 101 question for you, Professor? And again, please feel free to correct any of this narrative where it's wrong here. But, you know, you go back to the financial crisis, and you had institutions that were leveraged at, 30 to 1, 33 to 1, 35 to 1, which in my, again, not very highly trained mind, just means that you couldn't possibly pay to cover your debts there, that you're over-leveraged to a point of disaster, which makes it very interesting to me to hear that 6 to 7 or 8 to 1 is somewhat more palatable. It still feels like a lot, but it's nothing compared to where we were leading up to the crash. But Glass-Steagall didn't impact some of these institutions' capacity to get over-leveraged that way. Is that correct?
Well, when Glass-Steagall began, there was no FDIC. So the idea that depositors would be covered by Uncle Sam's insurance, or at least up to a point, didn't exist. So the banks, and Joe mentioned this, that, you know, the banks had some incentive to want to take this depositor money and then play Russian roulette with it. But now think about it, when Uncle Sam's guaranteeing a certain amount of that depositor money and you then go play Russian roulette, you really are absolutely in no bad shape at all as far as an investment bank is concerned, because you know that your losses are going to be socialized, but the profits will stay privatized. And Glass-Steagall addressed this in a small way, but it's not the key panacea or the key solution or set of solutions in today's complex world.
We talked about capital requirements. I mean, how are they leveraged now? I sure as heck hope it's not 30 to 1 anymore. I don't think it is, but I don't know.
I don't either. I don't think it's 30 to 1 either. It's probably single digits, but, you know, that kind of information is typically proprietary. They're not going to come and tell you, well, this is what we're doing.
See, that's what makes me, again, still slightly nervous about all of this. Well, before I get back to your phone calls, some of you have asked about the Republican side of this, because some listeners said they were emailed to say, I'm surprised to hear that both candidates agree with this, that the Republicans are on board with bringing back Glass-Steagall. This is from CNBC, July 19th, and I will quote there. Quote, Wall Street is not pleased. A top advisor to presumptive GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump, again presumptive because this was last month, said that the party wants to reimplement Glass-Steagall. After the surprise announcement, which came on the first day of the Republican National Convention, Wall Street sources sounded off on the idea that a Republican would reverse course on policies nearly 20 years old and now taken for granted by big banks. One lawyer who works with financial institutions on behalf of a firm in New York called the idea scary. Even Wilbur Ross, one of the Trump campaign's biggest supporters from the finance industry, called it surprising. Others on Wall Street who spoke to CNBC used stronger language that cannot be printed, end quote. So Wall Street thought they would have allies, at least from Trump, from Republicans, and at least in the platform, they don't. But yesterday, at Trump's economic policy speech, he talked about deregulating almost ad nauseum. And remember, we're talking Glass-Steagall, which is more regulation. Here's what Trump had to say about regulation.
It is time to remove the anchor dragging us down. And that's what it's doing. It's dragging us down. Upon taking office, I will issue a temporary moratorium on new agency regulations.
All right, so Trump was speaking about regulation more broadly, economic regulations on everything from small businesses to banks. But CNBC reacted to that by saying, listen, that's a wink, wink, nod, nod. He didn't have a passage in his 70-minute speech on Glass-Steagall. His economic advisors, there are 13 white men, five of whom are named Steve, which is fascinating to me. Lots of Steves. And most of them, I think all of them, come from hedge funds and that kind of a sector. And so anyway, CNBC is taking this as, you know, you can't be for Glass-Steagall and then say you don't want any regulation, moratorium on all regulations. Professor, is that a fair, is there dissonance there?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And Mr. Trump's plans are big on bombast, but have very little detail, so it's hard to tell what he exactly means when he says that, you know, the anchor is dragging us down.
All right, so I think what CNBC is, they're sort of winking at Wall Street saying, come on, guys, if this guy's in office, we're not going back to Glass-Steagall. Do you, I mean, I don't, you're not a political analyst, you're an economics guy. Do you think there's some legitimacy to that?
Well, my gaze into my crystal ball tells me that anything can happen with Mr. Trump. And in fact, there is some legitimacy. Yes.
Okay. All right. Let's get back to your phone calls. Fred in Penfield. Next up. Go ahead, Fred.
Yes, I want to thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening carefully and trying not to exaggerate or prolong my questions. But the fact is that when Dodd-Frank was passed, this was discussed ad nauseum, the reinstitution of Glass-Steagall, and everybody who got to the table said, oh, no, we don't need anything that severe. We don't need it. Well, the fact is that the reason we had Glass-Steagall refuted or turned down in 1990 or whatever it was because the banks wanted to defect, wanted to protect the 1% people, and that they only had the 1% people sitting at the table when they passed Dodd-Frank. And you can't just talk about the Glass-Steagall, because the fact is that that's just the icing on the cake. That's the what you've got is a situation that is more easily reflected in amounts. We lost, cumulatively, globally, we lost $30 to $60 trillion because of what happened in 2007, 2008. And nobody went to jail in this country. And when we got around to talking about should anybody go to jail, the FBI said we could never hire enough lawyers. They said we could never hire enough lawyers to enforce the standards of neglect or of criminal negligence that we know happened. And we're back in that same situation. Because every third day somebody says, oh, it could happen again, but we know it won't because we're watching it. But what Friedman was quoted as saying, 2007, I knew they could do this, that is cheat, and cheat on mortgages and on retirement incomes, but I never thought they would. That's what Friedman said. And they'd already started in the process of things that cost $30 to $50 trillion.
All right, so Fred, why don't you stay on the line, and why don't we let our guests respond to some of what you said there, because I think you're giving us a lot to kind of chew on here. Gentlemen, you want to jump in there? Professor Badabiel, want to start? Go ahead.
Well, the caller is absolutely right that, you know, it was a huge problem with major losses throughout the world, and it is true that no one in the United States went to jail as a result of their, what shall we say, wanton and reckless behavior in the financial activities area. But, you know, looking forward, we have to ask ourselves, well, it was a huge problem, and it is true that no one went to jail. But what do we do to make sure that at least the likelihood of something like this happening on the scale that it happened does not happen? So if we can successfully reduce the likelihood of something like this not happening again, then I think it's a big step forward. And in as far as this likelihood aspect is concerned, Glass-Steagall alone is going to do precious little. In large part, as we've been discussing, because of the complicated nature of the financial realm that we live in today, and because, as I pointed out a couple minutes ago, there were different categories of financial institutions who would not have been subject to Glass-Steagall, even if it had been law, who were nonetheless reckless and responsible for a big part of the mess, such as traditional banks, example Wachovia, and such as pure investment banking firms, example Bear Stearns.
Okay. Joe, you want to add? Fred, go ahead.
Let me respond just for a moment and then get off the line.
Okay.
The one thing that's most difficult for little people like us to talk about is how did it happen that the pundits and the presidents, and the SIC, and the SEC, and legislators stood around the table in 2000, 1999 or 2000, whatever it was, and they all agreed with Friedman that this could never happen. And then after they agreed, it did happen, and nobody went to jail. And we do not now, under Dodd-Frank, we do not now have either enough FBI agents or enough informed and paid regulators to stop it from happening again, because we'd have to make the same decision. We can't put all the bankers in jail, and we can't put the president in jail, and we can't dismiss the SEC, take their jobs away, just because they did it again. We knew it would happen again. Everyone told us it would happen again. You've got to enforce laws. That's it.
Fred, thanks very much for the phone call from Penfield. Joe Boyd, I'll let you weigh in on some of what you heard there.
I guess I would say that, you know, kind of going back to what Amit just mentioned as well, is that, you know, what was happening back in 1999, when they repealed Glass-Steagall, essentially through the new legislation, and they thought maybe could not happen again in the future, maybe wasn't really envisioned in what led to the financial crisis in 2008, 2009. Again, it's a lot of moving parts. It's very complicated when you really start digging into what led to the financial crisis. And so I understand where the listener is frustrated. I mean, I'm a little person as well. I'm only 5'8". But you know, I guess the best thing that we can do is just, and this is what I actually recommend to all my clients, is you need to understand what you own. You need to understand what you're doing, what you're investing in, because at the end of the day, if something goes wrong, then at least you know what went wrong, versus being surprised and saying, well, how did that happen? And then not knowing why or how that happened. I guess that's all I can really add to that.
Well, speaking of what we're telling investors, a different listener sends me an email to an article from Fox Business that I missed last week. I try to keep track of just about everything Donald Trump is saying, but there's a lot. And he does a lot of interviews. You got to give him that. Does a heck of a lot more than Hillary Clinton does. And this is what Donald Trump said about investment in the market last week to Fox Business News. Trump on Tuesday urged his supporters holding 401k to get out of equities as interest rates set by the Federal Reserve are inflating the stock market. Quote, I did invest and I got out, and it was actually very good timing, the Republican presidential nominee said in a phone interview with Fox Business. Quote, but I've never been a big investor in the stock market. Interest rates are artificially low. The only reason the stock market is where it is because you get free money. And Trump went on to warn of very scary scenarios coming for investors. That is doomsday kind of stuff. Get out of the market, Joe. I doubt you're telling people at Brighton Securities, your clients, to get out of the market.
You would be correct.
That's a fair one.
And
is this reckless? I mean, again, you're not endorsing or attacking. Right. I just want to know if you think this kind of rhetoric is reckless.
Well, I guess first thing that I would say is, you know, going back to some of my history, personal history, when I was an auditor for quality assurance, quality control, is, you know, in God we trust, all else provide documentation. So in regards to Donald Trump's comments of, you know, he got into Apple at this point, he got out of Apple at this point, I mean, I guess anybody could say that, and so unless we have actual proof, I guess you'd have to just, you know, take that into account for when he says that he got out of the market. As to what he said about—
I don't have his tax returns, Joe, do you?
No, and I don't think anybody does except for him.
No, that's right. He just hasn't been able to get that audit done.
He's always being audited.
Yeah, it's always, it's just a never-ending audit. Go ahead, Joe.
But what he was saying about, you know, the low cost of capital, essentially free money, so to speak— I mean, there has been talk, there have been articles out there that talk about how that has inflated asset prices, and, you know,
I'm not doubting that. I'm saying, right. Is the conclusion then telling people get out of equities? You know, what happens if all of Trump voters are doing that?
That's a good question. I really don't know. And if I had a crystal ball, I think I would be very, very rich. But I don't. And for me to speculate one way or the other than just, you know, saying what I say to my clients, know what you own, make sure that you're diversified, and, you know, make sure that you know why you have it.
Okay, but you're not saying get out of equities. Right. How do you feel about that?
Well, You know, anything Mr. Trump says, you never know to what extent to believe. And, you know, he suggests that he's able to time the market perfectly, know exactly when to get in and when to get out. So that's, I don't think, true at all. But more generally, getting out of equities, well, let me backtrack a little. The decision in terms of what kind of asset to invest in is fundamentally related to one's tolerance for risk. So people who are playing the equity markets big time tend to be, all else being equal, more risk-loving than more conservative folks. So depending on your age and depending on what you're investing in, you typically need to be investing in a balanced portfolio rather than playing stocks only, which I suppose you can do if you have money to throw away, recognizing that, you know, that's where the risks are, but then that's also where the rewards are.
And corrections are part of market history. We know 10, 15, sometimes even 20% corrections are natural and normal. And the next time it happens, I guarantee you Donald Trump will say he's going to claim credit for it as if he's the only one. And it could be 4 years from now. You know, he could be sitting there out of the game on the sidelines, but then he'll say, well, I knew that correction was coming. Rick in Bath, next up. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah. I think the whole problem, and it stems right down the line, everybody knows that, is without term limits, the politicians are holding to all the money, and until that, and they won't touch term limits until that happens. None of these regulations are ever going to be, you know, tight enough to keep things under control. So that's my comment for today.
Well, Rick, thank you. And again, this is more of a geared toward the political science folks, but I don't disagree with you that term limits are not likely to be happening anytime soon. Let me grab another email, and a long email from a listener named Dave. I don't have time to read the whole thing, but I want to read his conclusion, because Dave has been listening to the comments that Joe Boyd and Amit Badibial have been making about Glass-Steagall and how things are different between 1933, when this law was passed, and today, if it comes back, say as early as next year. And Dave writes and says, we need to reinstate an updated version of Glass-Steagall, one that addresses other financial vehicles of economic mass destruction. So, in other words, Joe, if we see Glass-Steagall revived, exhumed, it would probably be updated language anyway. But
2.0.
Yeah, but Dave is saying it has to be. You make sense?
Yes, and I think that's exactly what I was saying before, is that it needs to be Glass-Steagall-esque, but that applies to today's situation. And I was in a conversation with some coworkers yesterday. One of the things that he mentioned, and, you know, forgive me because I'm not a mechanic or very mechanically inclined, but he was saying something to the effect that if you brought in your car today to get it serviced for some reason or other, you know, the mechanic wouldn't be looking for the carburetor or wouldn't be looking for, you know, whatever makes the engine start, they'd probably start looking at the computer first. So to go back and try and fix a car from today that uses a computer to start with a carburetor, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. You need to use what today's situation is.
Yeah. Okay. Professor?
Yes, I'd agree with that. Glass-Steagall plus.
Okay. And before I let you go, we lose the hour. This is, I think it's related. It's not Glass-Steagall, but the last time Amit was here, we talked trade, and we talked your concern that, you know, that trade is being demonized in this election. Now you've got Hillary Clinton saying she is also against TPP now after the pressure from Bernie Sanders, even though Terry McAuliffe, one of her good friends and the governor of Virginia, sort of indicated, well, when she's in office, she'll support a version of TPP. But the bottom line is she is publicly opposing it now. Obviously, Donald Trump is opposing it now. Are you any less concerned about rhetoric about trade? I mean, how do you see at least the rhetoric about trade right now?
Okay, so first, a bit of a shameless pitch in the interest of time. I have an op-ed article coming out on Friday.
Well, good timing, because I only have a minute, so we'll have to read that
in much greater detail.
Okay.
But basically,
where's the article going to be?
In the Rochester Business Journal.
Okay, Friday.
On Friday. So there is no doubt that trade, free trade in particular, has brought advantages to many, many thousands of people all over the world. But the problem is with globalization, or what we call globalization, with any free trade agreement, there are winners and losers. But in this case, the losers have happened to be middle-class American workers. They have been hit hard, particularly those working in the manufacturing sector, and they see no benefits. So the government needs to do a lot more than what it is doing right now to make sure that these people's lives are better affected with training programs and assistance programs of a sort that we simply don't see. Otherwise, you're going to have very little support for free trade agreements. Now, as far as the TPP in particular is concerned, it's hard to pass judgment on it because nobody really knows what it contains. Everything's been secret. You know, all of the people who are passing judgments, they're just passing judgments on little snippets that have, you know, leaked out here and there. Except for President Obama's inner team, we don't know what the contents are.
Yeah, the president says, trust me.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and this one, and that lack of transparency does not build public confidence.
That is right.
All right, so Friday, the RBJ.
Right.
An op-ed from Ahmed on trade there. I think from Brexit to this election climate here, you see the fear of globalization at the very least.
That's right.
All right, so thank you for being here, Professor. Always great learning from you. We appreciate your time here.
Thank you for having me.
And Joe Boyd from Brighton Securities. Thank you, Joe. I think the panel agreeing that whether Glass-Steagall comes back or not, don't expect it to be the panacea. Learn a lot more, dig more, and Joe says know where your money is. Short break and more connections next.